Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast where we talk with authors about the most recent monographs in the field of folklore studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the podcast, and today I talk with Dori Noyes about Humble Theory, a book she recently published with Indiana University Press. Dori is professor of English and Comparative Studies at The Ohio State University and also president of the American Folklore Society. In Humble Theory, Noyes takes aim at the central questions and theories of our discipline and proposes that the questions proper to our field are not why questions, but how questions about the life of forms in society. How do forms move across time and space and remain recognizable? How do the people who recurrently interact in a given situation generate forms in common? And how do those forms work back again upon their makers? How is form marked by voice, such that we can recognize it as folk, or as Cajun, or as mine, or as other? Meanwhile, in our current moment of fake news, Me Too, and Black Lives Matter, these questions are quite valuable, even as the Academy finds precious little space for them. Ultimately, it seems that both the strength and the weaknesses of folklore might simultaneously lie in the fact that the field and its theories are humble, low, and close to the ground. Let's listen to the interview. Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast in which we talk with authors of the latest monographs in the field of folklore studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Dori Noyes to discuss her 2016 volume, Humble Theory, Folklore's Grasp on Social Life. Professor Noyes is professor of English and Comparative Studies at The Ohio State University and also now president of the American Folklore Society. She is a giant in our field, and I'm delighted that she's made time for us today. Dori, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Dr. Thurston.
So I guess to begin, I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit about yourself. What is your folklore origin story?
Mine, I guess, is different from a lot of people who come in with the field, well, who come in from the field and in a sense go back home to do their work. I am a library rat from Evanston, Illinois, and I grew up, I think, extremely shy and withdrawn. And when I was in college, I did really medieval studies. I learned some languages and I read a lot of ancient texts, and I really didn't engage with anything later than Jane Austen. And this made it a bit difficult for me to engage with my own peer group and to live in the world around me. So I discovered, I happened to be an undergraduate at Indiana, which of course has the iconic folklore program in the U.S. I was not a folklore major. I actually went there because I wanted to be an opera singer, but timidity didn't work well in that department either. So I came really by accident in my last semester there upon some of the grad students in folklore, because I was taking a class in medieval Celtic literature, and from the things that they had to offer to that class, I started to realize that there were, well, that I was selling the contemporary world a bit short, but also that the kind of methods and obsessions that I had picked up in the course of my education might be useful in this realm. So when I finished my undergrad degree, I went to work in the bike business because my only semi-marketable skill was speaking Italian. And I had a job for a year and a half. I met my husband there, so it wasn't lost time. But I spent a year and a half receiving the phone calls from angry Italians. And I did a lot of explaining to them that the American economy was in crisis and they couldn't get paid yet. So that made me feel that perhaps I should go back to grad school. And I started reading folklore books at the Evanston Public Library. And then that is how I got recruited. It was getting out of the bike business.
Oh, wow. That's quite the beginning, I think. Okay. And so in between the current book that we're going to be discussing today and you're leaving the bike business, I guess you spent a lot of time in Catalonia and wrote your first book, A Fire in the Plaza, yeah?
Yeah, I ended up doing field work in Catalonia also as an well, also as a kind of accident. I learned Catalan by mistake when I was at Indiana because I was trying to study Provençal because, as I said, I was going to be a medievalist, but there wasn't a class and there was one in Catalan. And I think I maybe learned early that if you want to get a reputation for knowledge, you can do this more easily by knowing things that everybody in the world, everybody else does not know. I suppose I've always been a bit of an intellectual claustrophobe. And so by learning something obscure, I suddenly had, a skill that impressed people enough to admit me into grad school. Anyway, so I was looking around really for Catalan topics just when I was writing seminar papers in grad school at Penn and came upon the Patum in looking for a paper to write about folk drama. And so as a result of that, I ended up going off to Catalonia for field work in a way that was really transformative. Living in a small city in the foothills of the Pyrenees, in what you might call Catalonia's Appalachia, the deindustrializing part of a prosperous industrial region, where people really had a sense that their world, you know, the circumstances of their very intense local festival life were coming to an end, but that the skills they'd learned along the way were going to be really valuable for the future. So the Patum was a highly vital festival. A festival that grows out of a religious occasion, Corpus Christi, which is the festival of the body of Christ in the Catholic Church. And as a kind of vernacular response to the very hierarchical social body represented in the Corpus Christi procession, the church procession, these kind of folk performances inserted themselves and adopted a very ambiguous but very, very powerful symbolic language of these dancing figures, giants and dwarves, mules with firecrackers in their mouths, eagles with crowns on their head, flaming devils, most of all. And these figures clearly referenced differences in the local community, differences of class, differences of gender, differences of origin, immigrant and indigenous. You know, they referenced a whole lot of the sources of conflict that were endemic in that community and in Spain at large and in Europe at large. And because this was all nonverbal, it could lend itself to multiple interpretations that would both allow it to survive over time. Nobody ever really outlawed this thing because you could always argue that it represented the triumph of Catholicism or it represented the triumph of the revolution or it represented the triumph of General Franco or sort of whatever they needed to say at the moment. But that vagueness also meant that everybody within a very claustrophobic local community, which, you know, any tightly integrated community is also a place of conflict, that vagueness also gave everybody an angle of participation, a different sort of stance that they could assume. So that was, I think, a great instructive experience for me, not only in the experience of being thrown in, because as I say, I was a library rat, and here I was setting my head on fire, essentially, and having all sorts of exotic things poured down my throat and dancing and doing a whole lot of things that I do not do, and really undergoing what it means to live in the body in a constrained space among other people. So that's both the community life and in a very concentrated, ludic, wonderful way what the festival is about. You know, so I learned what it was to live in the middle of a place that takes conflict for granted instead of assuming that it can reconcile and sort out and come to a unified understanding, which as an American, of course, I had taken as normative, really. So it was a great political education. It was a great introduction to a kind of theorizing that does not work through abstraction, you know, doesn't work from drawing back from experience and trying to reach general terms, but rather works through embodiment that kind of plays out over and over again that same central conflict, but each time plays it out a bit differently. Each time plays it out in a different moment with a different mix of players. You know, it's never really clear whether this battle between the Turks and the Christians is won by the Turks or the Christians. Everybody's still alive at the end. And it seems maybe that during the Franco regime, when everybody was pretty much forced to be a good Catholic if they wanted to eat, it seems that that was the moment at which one of the Turks in this symbolic battle started getting away at the end, you know, was not slain at the end along with the others. Anyway, so this was a kind of conflict that kept eternally replaying itself and where nobody ever really went away. And that got me to thinking differently about how society works, about how theory works, and about how my own life might work.
And so I wonder, this sounds like quite a different sort of project from the book that we're discussing today, this new book, Humble Theory, which is not sort of an ethnography of just one community and one event, but sort of a very, very wide-ranging sort of work. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book now.
Well, Humble Theory wasn't a project at all. It was composed, I should say, by invitation from Indiana University Press. This is really a book of collected essays, revised and sort of sequenced in ways that I hope are at least a bit cumulative, but it does reflect the accidents of career in a way that I think all of our mature work does as scholars. Your dissertation and your first book, as you know, is something that where you go out, I think, to test yourself against the field, where you go out to have a kind of transformative encounter with the real. But then if you have, you know, what for me and for many is very good fortune of ending up in the academy, you are sort of pulled back from that primary engagement. And especially for me, because my training was in folklore, it wasn't in Catalan studies. Catalan studies, at the time when I got my degree, no more than folklore was Catalan studies a rich field of potential tenure track jobs. And I was not trained as a Hispanist. So really the larger context for teaching and doing Catalan studies, you know, and being in a Spanish department, I really didn't have the background that qualified me for that. So by great good fortune, I ended up in an English department and in the interdisciplinary folklore program, which, of course, you know well at Ohio State, where perhaps in my career here, which is now 22 years, I think I have had one abortive master's student and at present one PhD student working in Catalan studies. But the rest of my career, I have been teaching and advising students working in Turkey, students working in Appalachia, students working in Iran, students working, as you know, in China. So I had to really rethink my teaching in terms of what would be comparatively useful. And in a sense, you know, so I think it did come out of that first field experience in a couple of ways. First of all, in that they in Berga also had a very comparative consciousness because they knew they were not the center of the world. You know, I mean, I shouldn't say that. They created themselves as a center of the world for the moment of the festival, understanding that their reality, their external circumstances made them provincial and made them dependent on somewhere else, made them defined by others. Not really very interested in that predicament, and as that in that predicament as a sort of comparative way about thinking about the places in the world that folklorists characteristically study, the places or the social strata, the kind of field sites that we seek. So bringing with me that idea of understanding oneself comparatively, of having to build solidarities by thinking comparatively, and also that notion of vernacular theory, which gave birth in part to the sense of humble theory, all of that led into the book. But the book came out of initially assignments I got from the field, and especially, you know, the most famous thing I've ever written, the thing I'm most sick of, honestly, the essay group, which already in 1995 I was asked to do for the Journal of American Folklore for a special issue on keywords in folklore. And there I was asked to think about this concept of community, which we are all in love with, versus more sociological objectivist kinds of notions of social group, and versus the sort of stigmatizing categories such as folk, with which many of the actors we study have been touched. So that was a first important comparative project for me. And as a result of that, I ended up getting asked to address our other big problems. What's tradition? You know, or what are aesthetics in folklore? These sort of global questions. And I guess when you're invited, especially when you're young and you're invited, you don't say no. But it also became a kind of practical problem for me, and one that very much, you know, concerns me now as president of the American Folklore Society. The question of what indeed are the core, if not the core concepts, the core problems that unite a field that is both small in its absolute numbers, the number of professionals in the world who call themselves folklorists, and enormous in its scope. All of us working out everywhere in the world on every kind of phenomenon, on festival, on personal narrative, on animal story, on material culture, on vernacular architecture, on belief. Our empirical scope is so vast, our numbers are so small, that and also our local institutional affiliations. I think the fact that we have been able to adapt ourselves to a wide range of institutional contexts, some of us in many parts of the world working at national research institutes where our brief is culture defined in national terms, some of us working in programs where we are encouraged and allowed to be theorists, some of us working in archives very particularly defined, and many of us working attached to a whole range of disciplines, history, literature, you know, art history, musicology, all of these things. So with all of those, with the ability we've developed to fit ourselves into a variety of institutional ecologies and conversations, that has also made for a great diversity of theoretical frameworks, a great diversity of vocabularies. And to pull all that together and try to define the there, is something I felt compelled to do, first for the sake of my own career, and then for the sake of my interdepartmental program at Ohio State, and now, of course, for the sake of the society. So the book, the essays, most of the essays in the book are really exercises in pulling the pieces together in ways that I hope are useful to others, but at any rate were useful to me as trying to not dissolve the particulars, but to understand the family resemblances among them, the historical circumstances from which we came, and the kinds of questions and arguments that can now keep us in conversation.
Ah, great. Okay. You know, that actually sort of dovetails nicely with the question I was going to ask next, is sort of getting us towards the contents of the book itself. The book's title, Humble Theory, it's also the title of one of your chapters, which is in turn a reprint of an earlier Journal of Folklore Research article. So I guess this is a pretty important term for us to unpack sort of in understanding the larger project. What do you mean by humble theory?
So it has two opposites, you could say. You know, all concepts are contrastive. They're all formed in opposition to something. And the initial contrast was with grand theory, and an additional contrast is with high theory. So grand theory, without you understand being particularly accomplished in these matters, I understand grand theory as belonging to the social sciences, and being associated, you know, especially with these sort of great 19th century synthetic thinkers in that respect, you know, the Freuds and Marxes and the kinds of the world who are looking for a unifying principle, a sort of deep structure, if we take it forward to Levi-Strauss, that accounts for the diversity of reality that we see before us. So, you know, Freud takes us back to a particular scene of creation. You know, Freud takes us back to the psyche and its sort of primordial conflicts. Marx takes us back to takes us back to the economy and to these sorts of fundamental conflicts within economic structure. Levi-Strauss takes us really back to cognitive problems, but they're all trying to find, you know, a kind of original scene, a kind of deep problematic that will get us towards diversity. And that longing for theory, of course, is also a longing for respectability. In social scientific terms, it's about being able to have a kind of cumulative theory that allows us to generate hypotheses and make predictions. And Humble Theory, the essay, was immediately a part of a somewhat traumatic moment in the history of the field when one of our great innovators from the sort of 1968 era of new perspectives in folklore, Alan Dundas. Alan Dundas was part of a group of innovators that were nominated the Young Turks, the sort of revolutionaries, by Richard Dawson, the sort of keeper of the establishment at that time. And all of them were really interested in revitalizing folklore studies from a greater emphasis on method and classification and the tracing of text to a driving theory that would make it more like social science, that frankly would make it sexier and more respected, but also that would associate it more with dynamism in the world. This was really a group of scholars who came in the age, who came of age in the 1960s, who saw folklore being active in the world because they were looking at the way that songs were being used on the barricades of the civil rights movement, of student protests. They were looking at the way that festival forms and narrative forms were being brought into struggles for civil rights and for decolonization and for local sorts of assertion. So they were looking for theory as a way of turning folklore into a social science. And they did various kinds of experiments along these lines, some of which worked better than others. And I'll come back to the one that I think worked in a moment. But Alan Dundas, of course, was one of these. And he tried out a lot of different paradigms in his first years, particularly structuralism. And then psychoanalytic theory, and he got, I think, really hung up, and I will say, frankly, stagnated in a certain rather limited model, rather limited Freudian model, interpretive model, understanding folklore, the texts and the sort of objects that we have as the product of psychic conflict and repression and narrativization, these sort of Freudian processes. Anyway, he went off to Berkeley and sort of did this in a sense, his own fortress. Had not engaged with the field for a long time, had not been to a meeting of the American Folklore Society for a long time. And then he was invited back to give a keynote address at the American Folklore Society annual meeting. And that was, what year was that? 2000, I think it was either 2003 or 2004. And he basically said, folklore has no grand theory and we are not taken seriously because of this. And in going back to look for grand theory, he was really going all the way back to the 19th century to Fraser, and really simply looking at, you know, generalizations that you could then go out and test somewhere. And Elliot Oring, of course, is I think sustaining this sort of push towards testable generalizations at the moment, but it created a kind of startled reaction, certainly among our students in the field, and some pushback among people who felt that folklore had, in fact, been moving along more productive theoretical lines. And so as a result of that, Lee Herring organized a session at AFS in 2005 to ask, why is there no grand theory in folkloristics? And a variety of responses were given to this, most of which were that we are working at a theoretical level that is appropriate for us, that grand theory is not really what we're aspiring to do. And I think the sort of useful piece that came out of this session, all of these, of course, were published in the Journal of Folklore Research, but Richard Bauman's formulation of the philology of the vernacular, I think, put forward a viable version of the field, and certainly, I think, an account of what the American field has been doing. But what I wrote, really following in part along the example of Margaret Mills, who says, well, we do love, we are doing theory that comes from closer to the ground, comes from often the people we are working with, and comes in response to trying to answer questions at a more localized or particularistic level. So I was thinking about that in thinking what I myself would say about grand theory. And I was also thinking about myself in an English department where there's not what I think you would call grand theory in the sense that it is trying to be theory of everything, but there is high theory, the kind of high theory that we associate certainly with post-structuralism, that is working at a level not accessible to certainly not accessible to those subaltern actors it's often talking about. High theory is in a sense greatly theory about theory, and its theorists talking among themselves, really, at a level that is greatly illuminating, and a lot of it has reached something I would call truth. But as Johannes Fabian, the anthropologist Johannes Fabian, loves to say, it doesn't get me through the day. It doesn't get me through the day. It's not a level at which I was trained. It's not a level at which I see myself working. And I think it's not a level that serves a field like ours, which really lives in multiple locations, some of which are very close to the ground. So folklore has, as I said in the Humble Theory article, you know, we have academics who are in the business of bringing bringing vernacular insights into academic conversation, playing a kind of mediating role that does contribute towards general theory. But we also have the archivists whose job it is to assemble and make accessible these kinds of insights. And then we also have the activists, those people who are working with communities, helping them to imagine how these questions of justice and equity might be addressed, how the projects that are implicit in folklore itself, the efforts to be heard, the efforts to command attention, the efforts at both recognition and reformulation of the world, the kinds of social theory that exist in folklore itself. You know, a number of people in our field are living in that world, are part of that world. And so high theory would not work for most of us. And grand theory is, again, it may be true, but it doesn't get us through the day. We who deal with particulars, you know, we who deal with the surface of things and the kind of human interactions and negotiations that take place through particulars and on the surface, that's not the level of theory that gives us what we most need. And so I think what has worked in our field, in the US sort of variant of what we do, certainly, has been this kind of attention to the particulars of genre and of discourse, this sort of attention to surface level systematic features of text or of other kinds of social form, the attempt to turn that into an ethnography of communication, and the growth of that into performance theory, the sense that if we understand how texts or other communicative artifacts are generated in the world, how they are caught up and heard, how they are transformed and transmitted, if we look at that whole question of how stuff moves around in the world through forms, the question of how, not what is its, what are its deep roots, not what are its, you know, not what are its causes, but simply those how questions of how does this stuff get communicated? How does communication happen? How does form circulate? Those are useful questions. They have practical applications. These are questions that advertisers also ask. These are questions that political messengers also ask. They have practical applications. They are also, I think, of great theoretical importance at a level that is still relevant perhaps to the everyday consciousness of human beings who have to do stuff in the world. So my notion of humble theory, I think also finally had to do with what Jason Baird Jackson at Indiana calls the Americanist. He's talking about the sort of Boasian tradition of ethnography of communication that I'm talking about. Jackson calls this the Americanist tendency to theoretical modesty. And I think, honestly, modesty is appropriate for me if I'm trying to talk about theory. And I think about the field in that because we are weakly institutionalized, we're not in a position to form a grand theory if we wanted to. We really need to, I think, be having more integrated conversations among ourselves to come to not consensus about, not to consensus about theory itself, but really the terms of debate, simply to move towards a more unified vocabulary within which I think we can have more. We can refine our disputes. So humility seems to me an appropriate posture, I think. And so I took it from Charlotte's Web. You may remember that Charlotte's first big slogan for Wilbur the Pig was humble. She looked it up in she had a bit of a scrap of a dictionary, and humble means not proud and near the ground. And that, I think, is an appropriate stance for those of us who are trying to continue to engage with vernacular theory, with vernacular theorizing, which is a great, daunting, wonderful but intricate subject.
I'm glad you brought up that sort of that term, vernacular theorizing. I guess the remainder of part one, the sort of the work of folklore studies, sort of a lot of them are probably among your most well-known articles. Group, as you already mentioned, the social base of folklore, three strands of tradition, and Aesthetic is the opposite of anesthetic, which is personally one of my favorite titles out there. So because they're so well read, maybe we can skip to part two, entitled Histories and Economies of Tradition. This section really fascinated me personally, because it seems to me that you're examining the formulation of the folk and of tradition at different historical moments in the formation of what is at the moment our modern capitalist order, if you will. And in the introduction, you described this as coming out of an interest of moving an interest in provincial intellectuals and in moving beyond perhaps facile narratives of domination resistance and towards viewing folklore as vernacular theorization. And I guess I was wondering if you could expand upon how these chapters examining topics ranging from voice to fairy tale to myth to festival sort of coalesce into helping us understand these issues.
Yeah, I am delighted you asked about this section, because of course the first section is the essays that everybody has read, and these are the ones that nobody has read. So I sort of put them there in the middle, I guess, halfway between hoping that no one would notice and hoping that everyone would notice. But indeed, this is these reflect more of my particular interests, and they also reflect more of a European take on the field. So I think that in the US, where really from the very formulation of the field in 1888 by William Wells Newell, we have been thinking about folklore as the vernacular layer of culture that everybody has got. We are all the folk. We all have a level of participation in informal forms, non-institutionalized culture that is created in social interaction that depends on social interaction for its reproduction. And in the US, I think there are good political reasons for which it's been necessary to say that we are all the folk. And it really indeed began as a kind of equalizing gesture in contrast to evolutionary anthropology that was placing the evolved European male at the center of the world and the folk sort of along the way to that. And then the colonized and enslaved populations at a lower level. William Wells Newell really wanted to say everybody who ended up in, you know, who was already in that territory we now call the U.S. or who ended up here by the various means by which we ended up here, we all have cultural practices of a kind that can be studied with the tools of philology, the tools that grew into our ethnography of speaking. And all of these groups have history that has constrained their forms of expression. You can study the narratives of Native Americans, the narratives of freed slaves, the narratives of new immigrants, and the narratives of Boston Brahmins with the same message, with the same methods, and through the same logic. So that was an important foundation in the U.S. and one that's still with us. But in Europe, the framing has really been different, and it's been expressed most concisely in a fantastic article that has never been translated out of French and Italian by an Italian ethnologist named Alberto Cirese, who wrote in quite early, let's see, in 1967 or thereabouts, wrote about folklore as the, said that the proper scope of folklore studies was the study of cultural alterity and unevenness within the so-called superior societies. That is, folklore was the study of the contradictory zones within the modern, the sort of intimate alterity within the modern. And this is a conclusion that, of course, was independently reached by some American folklorists, such as Richard Bauman and Charles Briggs. But in Europe, it's really been an awareness that's much deeper. And so the idea that all kinds of difference within Western societies, whether this is regional difference, as in my interest in the provincial, whether it is social class difference, ethnic difference, gender, whether it has to do with the relation to the colonies, whether it has to do with the relationship to children and education, whether it has to do with disability, all of these kinds of differentiations that make a certain kind of unmarked actor, the bourgeois male of the dominant ethnicity who has entree into the Habermasian coffee house. You know, this is what a citizen looks like, and everybody else is in some fashion deviant. And that kind of deviation is really what Cirese marked out as our subject matter. And in that respect, I think the kind of standard history we give of the field, that it's all about nationalism, is much too reductive. And it's blinded us, I think, to some things that are useful. And this is part of what in, you know, this kind of episodic way that you see in these different essays, I have tried to recover in my historical work, beginning with a book I really hope I will have time and headspace to write when I retire, on a book on festivals in 17th century southern France, Occitanie, the zone of southern France that spoke Occitan, a sort of separate language from French, but that had come, this region that had come under French rule, and that in the 17th century was coming strongly under centralization, the real consolidation of the French state as a centralizing power that was ruling the provinces first by force, because these were areas that had had civil war going on. They were heavily Protestant areas, and they were, of course, also resisting centralization for the sake of the privileges of, you know, the local aristocracies. But these were rebellious regions that had been subdued first by force, then by taxation, and then by the kind of cultural initiatives of the French state to spread the French language, to spread French culture. Ultimately, you know, later in French history, through universal education, through a kind of imposed common narrative. And it seems to me that we can really go, we should be going back to the 17th century rather than the 19th to think about the real beginnings of the field. And Bauman and Briggs identified this in one way in Voices of Modernity. They identified the kind of Anglo-American side of this that has to do with primarily with ideologies of language and the birth of a modern idea of language as transparent and a sort of vehicle of information versus the realm of non-modernity, which is also the realm of poetry, language as expressive, language as sort of laden with meaning and tradition and symbolism. That's also a 17th century development that has to do with philosophical and scientific developments in England, religious Protestant, and then philosophical and scientific developments in places like England, and then in the US and Germany and elsewhere. But I think there's also a continental European history, and that's one that's more of interest to me as somebody who does the Romance languages, and more of interest to me as somebody who does festival. Already, if you go to 16th century Italy, you already have city-states in Italy that are differentiating themselves by adapting a common festival language to create sort of locally distinctive signifiers. And this kind of festival vocabulary in 17th century France and in 17th century southern France, I think also in the Low Countries, also in Catalonia with slightly different political logics, this festival vocabulary becomes a mode of political self-assertion for these people in provincial situations, these people in places like Toulouse and Montpellier and other cities in Languedoc that are no longer in control of their own political lives, that are, you know, that have now become defined as backward places in relation to Paris, that are now very clearly humbled places, you know, places that have been conquered and that now have to live under the rule of the French state. And the elites, and interestingly here it's the elites, it's not, I'm not talking here about lower class people. I'm talking about elites in these areas who begin to formulate a language of local identity that we're going to associate with folklore. So I have these incredible festivals in early 17th century Languedoc that, like the Patum, have these stressing animals. In Catalonia, which was rebelling with at least, well, which was having a civil war with the Spanish, with the Spanish state in the 17th century. They had these kicking mules. A mule is an animal you never domesticate very well. It's always violent. It's always sort of uppity. You always have to sort of beat it into submission. It's an animal that's sort of always in conflict, and it's a great symbol throughout history of the working class in America and African American culture also, which is another article that hasn't gotten anthologized yet. But getting back to the domestic animals, where Catalonia had this rebellious mule, I was startled to discover that that southern France had ponies and camels and horses, equines also, that acted out in the festival, were aggressive during the festival, but were sort of successfully domesticated at the end. And I discovered that there was a kind of consistent pattern of festival imagery. We are a domestic animal that is going to be tamed and ridden by you, but that still knows how to bite. There's still a kind of threat that the domesticated animal might go feral, might go wild. So that's one kind of imagery of the folk and imagery of peripheral regions. They have to be domesticated, tamed, incorporated into the household by force and, you know, also by affection, but mostly by force. Then there's another kind of symbolism, which is of the ruin, the, you know, southern France is a place that had Roman, great Roman civilization, great Roman cities, when Paris was nothing. And these are now ruins. And so there are all of these talking statues with, their heads knocked off, statues of old Roman emperors that get for these festivals, not only with new talking heads, but actually with other members of their body that have been knocked off and that sort of come back to life and rise up in these festivals. And the talking statues, kind of say, yeah, all right, we're defeated now, but we're not dead yet. And then figures of the ragged foreigner, figures of the Arab, both in Catalonia and in southern France, these figures of the Moor or the Turk. And these were kind of founding figures in this part of the world. They also had an important civilizing role in the local landscape. And they were also passing through, trading with the Mediterranean cities and also passing through southern France in the 17th century when the Muslims were expelled from Spain. And in these festivals, these places are talking about themselves as these sort of ragged foreigners who also are suffering in the present, but who still have a kind of liveliness, a creativity, and a power of threat to them. Things are happening to the language in the festivals at the same time. The local language is moving from something in which you can do dignity, something in which you can make serious claims. That register, the dignified register of the language, is going away. But the carnivalesque register of the language, the scatological, the silly, the sexual, is really asserting itself quite powerfully. I'm sorry, you see why I want to write this book and why I am going on about the 17th century. But, you know, that was really important for me to remember that as a whole, a lot of what gets called folklore around Europe has to do with these local political assertions, whether that is at the level of the region, you know, the region that's struggling for autonomy, as in Catalonia, whether it's at the level of the town that is, you know, clamoring for investment and political attention, which is the case in Languedoc in the 17th century, but it's also the case in all of the places that are looking for intangible cultural heritage investment right now, or whether you're talking about at the level of social class. And certainly the elites in Provence and Languedoc are are capturing plebeian forms. Those rebellious animals seem to have a much deeper medieval history. There are the amazing 14th century stories of young men taking a wild horse with fire in its mouth into a church and setting the church on fire. So there are, I think, deeper vocabularies of rebellion in what's happening in the 17th century. And those that sort of low sort of subaltern self-assertion comes back, of course, much more vigorously in the 19th century, where workers who have been displaced from their traditional commons and their traditional privileges begin to really intensify their performances of custom, again, as a way of saying, we're here, we are self-aware. And even if you recognize us as low, even if you recognize us as disorderly, even if you recognize us as not modern, by God, you still better recognize us. So there's, I think, a whole history of folklore and industrial class conflict. That's one of the important motors of the nationalism, because one of the things that nationalism is about is to construct a unity within the society that's going to bring the industrial working classes into alignment with elites, that's going to give them a sense of a common identity rather than a differential one. So paternalist practices in factories is something I learned about a lot in Catalonia. And just as it was important there, it was important in the US. Henry Ford and a whole lot of other a whole lot of other industrialists created the company town as a way of incorporating their workers into a framework that would get them away from labor unions and those kinds of contestatory self-assertion that also relied on folklore. You know, think about the role of gospel songs and folk song in the union movements in the U.S. But industrialists, like Henry Ford, were putting forward visions of cultural authenticity and were creating these kinds of pseudo-traditional communities that imagined the workers as folk, that imagined the workers as dancing their acquiescence, you could say, singing for the master, in the phrase of my old advisor, Roger Abrams, who wrote about this as part of plantation culture. That kind of culture began on the plantation, the folklorization of the subaltern, and it moved into the industrial world. And the alliance with nationalism, which kind of scaled this up to the level of the modern state, is an important one. So a lot of this history that I've done is really trying to complicate our sense of the range of political disputes that were going on through these assertions of the non within modernity, these assertions of traditional vocabulary as an idiom of political dispute. And the way that, of course, the later chapters, the sort of post-nationalist chapters, begin to deal with the ways that those formulas of the folk, those formulas of tradition, once they're created, can then get revised into both hegemonic projects like neoliberal and corporate culture, and also into new kinds of projects of political coexistence, as I think has happened with Brazilian traditional culture in Germany.
Great stuff. Let's turn to those post-nationalist ones. I really do like what I understand you meaning by that, at least. I'm certainly going to have to go back and reread part two based on our conversation just now, because there's a lot that it brought up for me. But I was wondering if we could now switch gears to part three, where you talk about slogan concepts and cultural regimes. Let's start out with this. What is a slogan concept?
So there are other words for this, and perhaps I'm not sure yet whether this one is completely distinctive. But most of us are familiar in the academy with Raymond Williams' great conception of the key word, words like culture or modernity, that come to mean way too much, you know, that get... they become terms, according to Williams, they become terms of sort of central contestation at key moments of social change. So Raymond Williams really got interested in this by thinking about what does culture mean and why is everybody talking about it all of a sudden in poor England? And he ended up going back to, the 19th century and looking at these arguments about culture as, you know, the best that has been thought and said, in Matthew Arnold's terms, versus the early anthropological conception of culture as sort of all of the forms and created ways of life that humans have produced. Anyway, these are terms that become bearers of social value, and they escape academic definition, because they're out there in the world circulating in ways that we can do nothing about. It's often been an embarrassment to folklorists that our terms, folklore, tradition, and so forth, circulate in these ways that are really more powerful than our power to control them. The Germans call this Rücklauf, which means a backflow or the sort of undertow of a wave. So the meanings of the folk out in the world are so dangerous and so powerful that many of us, of course, have contemplated jettisoning that term altogether simply because its dangerous uses are more powerful than our power to rein them in. But we have that notion of keyword, which, you know, for terms that are really central and unmasterable, like the modern. Then the kind of the other end of this continuum, I would say, is the buzzword. And, you know, so we think about this in the way that certain languages, certain terms come into corporate, come into management discourse or come into institutional discourse. And suddenly everybody is talking about response, or everybody is talking about you see, I try to repress the memory of all of these things, suddenly everybody's talking about agile management or something. I'm thinking of my husband's world of IT. You know, suddenly everybody's talking about agile programming. We all have to be agile. So a slogan concept I see as sort of halfway between the keyword and the buzzword. It might start in a buzzword, it might live long enough to become a keyword, but a slogan concept, I think, is a relatively openly defined, multivocal term that puts itself forward in the realm of policy as a source of solutions to a problem. And so I think if we think about terms like diversity, sustainability, intangible cultural heritage, which is, of course, what got me into all of this, and resilience, which I think is our key slogan concept of the moment. These are terms that are helping us to address problems that we perceive. So in the case of intangible cultural heritage, we are worried about cultural appropriation. What happens when the forms, the generative cultural forms that are created in a particular social location end up getting co-opted by somebody in a better position who is able to commercialize them and turn them into intellectual property and really get all the profit without having done any of the work? So we've had that as a kind of particular concern of the field. What happens to traditional forms when somebody takes them off and converts them to intellectual property? And of course, we've had the broader problem. This is why intangible cultural heritage got as far as UNESCO and other intergovernmental policy forums. The problem of uneven development. How do we deal with this enduring asymmetry between economic asymmetry, between those, the former, well, between the great powers, between the great powers, the former imperial states, and the so-called undeveloped part of the world that continues to struggle economically and that continues to serve as a source of either raw material for industry or raw labor for technological and service work, etc. These places that continue to be seen as sort of secondary and as resources for the rich world. So that large problem of uneven development, what do they have? What do they have that could become their own basis, their own foundation for economic development that would not be simply attaching themselves, but that would be sort of their own universe of innovation? And I think intangible cultural heritage put itself forward as a solution to that problem, in, to my mind, a very compromised solution for that problem, as is also cultural property, the other slogan concept about which I and my colleagues Regina Bendix and Kilian Bietzer have written. So those kinds of terms have come forward, and resilience, you know, I like many of these terms, right? Sustainability, I think, is terrific. I worry about the way, although, you know, the devil is always in the implementation. But I began to notice a few years ago that sustainability was beginning to give way to the term of resilience, or to be paired with the term of resilience. And also at the same time, I noticed it was the summer of, I think it was 2013. I've got to go look at my note here. Suddenly, people I saw talking about climate change were suddenly talking not about prevention, but were talking about adaptation. And in that same summer, when I started noticing this, I also found that every blockbuster movie I went to at my local theater was about the end of the world. They were all about the apocalypse. And it suddenly, I suddenly thought, oh my God, there's been a tipping point. We've given up. And then suddenly resilience was everywhere. And so I started looking at resilience. And again, while I would not dispute that, by God, we've all got to be resilient, given that many things are coming at us from all angles, both at the personal level of being resilient through whatever little crises life throws at you, and also at the global level of economic resilience and environmental resilience, resilience does seem to take for granted that stuff is going to happen. That is, you know, Donald Rumsfeld put it, stuff happens. You know, I was, I think, quite struck by finding this poster from an activist group in New Orleans, where there has been a great deal of policy invention in the post-Katrina world aimed at creating personal and institutional resilience. I found a poster on the street saying, "Stop calling me resilient, because every time you say, oh, they're resilient, that means you can do something else to me. I am not resilient." And it has always seemed to me that when you put these slogans forward, and this happened with cultural property in a research group, a wonderful research group that I was part of in Göttingen, the Göttingen Interdisciplinary Research Group in Cultural Property. When we talk about cultural property, we tend to fail to look at the sources of the problems that create the need to figure out what cultural property might look like, because we are so intrigued by this concept, because it's an oxymoron. The whole idea of property, you know, came up in the context of individualism and ideas of individual invention. Property law as we have it cannot currently be applied to collectivities. It cannot currently take account of revision and recreation and the tradition process, everything that shapes the kinds of practices that we would like to protect. So we all got so worried about saying cultural property is impossible, or, well, how could we fix it so that it would be possible? Would it be, you know, and how would that work? And would it be ethical? And would it solve the problem or not? And we got so concerned with first critiquing and then playing with and ultimately just naturalizing the term as something that's out there in the world that we stopped thinking really about, why do we even need this? And, you know, are there global problems, as indeed there are, which we discover not only from the context of vernacular tradition, but also from the context of high tech? Our intellectual property regime is, at this point, completely dysfunctional. It's in crisis. And by seeking this kind of band-aid of cultural property, we are not doing that overall revamping. We are not certainly doing the still larger revamping of global capitalism, which of course is a little bit tricky, challenging, large. You know, we're not looking at the causes. We are not looking at potential ways of reanalyzing the problem such that even if we're talking about the local community, we might find solutions that would not have to do with creating a new special case of intellectual property. So I think slogan concepts are very seductive. They sound good. Why would you say no to a property, right? They sound like they might, you know, they get you on board because they sound promising and really nobody else is offering you anything. So they win adherence. They win adherence in among academics and in the policy world because they're sort of where the action is and where the funding is. They, you know, they promise us something we can march behind towards a solution. But I think they then create this large blind spot on the other side that that keeps us from looking for multiple definitions of the problem. So I think they're very characteristic of our present era in that they do provide this this banner that we can get around in times of very little consensus about anything. They do provide global seeming slogans that seem to offer particular applications. They offer us some kind of hope that does not involve thoroughgoing revision of these, you know, inertial institutions among which we live. So I think they're very seductive in a global situation. And therefore, and they are slogans that our own field, of course, is being enticed to address. And we are jumping onto these bandwagons along with everyone else. But I see their dangers. And so I felt compelled to write about them.
It seems incredibly timely to sort of bring us to that, I think, because these These issues do, as you point out, seem to be more and more ubiquitous, whether it's disruption or heritage or, as you say, resilience. Now I note that you end without providing a solution, but sometimes the critique is enough. Well, I think we've taken up a lot of your time today. Thank you so much for talking with us through all these thoughts. Before we let you go, though, I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now or what you'll be working on next. Is it going to be the 17th century culture book, or is that still further down the road?
I haven't got the headspace to think carefully about the 17th century right now, just because I'm busy living in the 21st. But I have, in fact, been worried about doing a lot of critique and offering no solutions. And I'm not sure that my current project is quite addressing that problem. But I have been, in a sense, going back now to my own tradition, instead of studying somewhere else. I have been always interested in turning folklore's methods on elite Western practices, on dominant Western practices. And right now, I'm working slowly on a book that kind of goes back into my own cultural and political formation. I'm writing a book about exemplarity, and none of us really know what that means, but the idea of leading by example, the idea of setting examples, and what is, I think, an idea very deep, but very not fully theorized in liberal democracy, that we will achieve social progress by setting and following examples, so that initiatives will still come from individuals and local actors rather than being driven by centralization. But those individual and local initiatives will be emulated, be revised, be reformed, be improved, and they will ultimately lead to sort of phase shifts where there will be a positive transformation. And we all have certain icons of this. You know, Rosa Parks refuses to get off the bus, and everybody imitates that, and global attention is brought to it because it's such a striking, courageous, impressive gesture that seems to summarize a whole set of agitations that are happening elsewhere. And so I began by getting interested in that kind of power of the gesture. And what I'm moving now towards now, and the book is called Exemplary Failures, is really the way that exemplarity constitutes a tradition of political performance, one that really goes back to the Roman Empire, the kind of setting of an impressive example that causes other people, that inspires a kind of competitive emulation. And I'm writing through a long history that starts in the 18th century and picks out all of my favorite stories, of course, about exemplarity as a powerful tradition of political performance in Western societies that is so powerful, indeed, that it furnishes a kind of ideology of progress. But then I go into the way that that tradition of performance lost control of itself, really, with a change in the performance context. When you go from the small scale of person-to-person encounter, the scale of folklore, really, the scale where actors are continually co-present to one another, and you go to the context of the modern state and then the global universe, where performances have to be mediated, have to be communicated from a site of visibility to the rest of the world. The way that those performances sort of lose their moorings in that sense of person-to-person social responsibility, and instead we have this kind of uncontrolled mimesis, where the person who is screaming loudest for attention gets most of it, and the person who does the most outrageous thing inspires most emulation. And whether that speaks or not to our current political moment, I'll leave it to you to judge. But that's what I'm trying to figure out right now.
It sounds fantastic, and it sounds like something that will be very worth our attention in this age of aggregation. So I'm really looking forward to that. Well, I think we've taken up plenty of your time. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
All right. Take care.